Committee on Ways and Means for April 25, 2005. Open a hearing on SB 5522. Dr. Kohler.
That's one.
For the sake of ease, I think, I don't know what my colleagues to the left have done, but I think similar. We've just put everything into the booklet at the back.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Peter Kohler, Oregon Health and Science University, and we are going to start this morning with testimony from Dr. Halleck.
Thank you, Dr. Halleck. Chairman Devlin and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Leslie Halleck. I'm the provost at Oregon Health and Science University. We distributed a packet of information to you this morning, and I understand that some of you have already put it in your notebooks. I'll just describe the four items in the packet briefly. The thickest item on top represents essentially a subset of the slides that you had on last Wednesday. I thought it would be easier to give you the actual slides we're going to be using today to follow so we weren't flipping through the document. So depending on time, of course, we may still do a little flipping, but this is the material that we're going to talk about today, so it's a condensed version of some of the material from last time. In addition, there are three other documents in your packet, and we'll address those as we come to them, but just so you know what you have. The first is essentially a white paper in response to a request from Senator Gordley on health care for all Oregonians, and really addresses some of the issues of uncompensated and undercompensated care in Oregon. And it's called Health Care for All Oregon. All Oregonians. And then there are two letters. One letter to Senator Walker in response to her request to have information about President Kohler's compensation package, and the details are in there. And the final document is a letter to Senator Schrader, to Co-Chair Schrader, which is a response to the document that was cited in the testimony last Wednesday from Senator Schrader, entitled An Open Letter on Oregon Health and Science University Funding. So this is a response, and again, we'll mention it as we come to the points in it, in the testimony. This is sort of a condensed outline of the material that was remaining requested in the Phase 2 hearings. And so these are the elements in those hearings that were required or requested. And I neglected to take my cheat sheet time off there, so it gives you a preview of how long we think each one will take. Obviously, that's subject to your wishes. This slide is new, and it simply reiterates some of the things we've said, but because of some of the discussion last time, I wanted to just remind the committee of a couple of principles, and I will be pointing to these principles at several times in the testimony where appropriate. One is that although the state appropriation is a small percentage of the total OHSU budget, it's allocated in a very specific way and to those programs that are unable to be self-sustaining in the absence of such a subsidy. And those programs, as you'll see from the data, are highly dependent upon that state funding. The state funding, in fact, is distributed rather specifically for educational programs in three of the four schools, the schools of medicine, nursing, and dentistry, as you heard from Mr. Bender last week. And in addition to help fund uncompensated or undercompensated care for the poor, those activities are either in the CDRC, the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center, or in the university hospitals and clinics. The specific cuts within the governor's recommended budget, I apologize for the acronym, were made from those programs that are funded by state dollars. Programs and functions that do not receive state funding, of course, were not considered for these cuts. For example, most of the research institutes, and the research programs, because we do not use state appropriation to fund research. However, those programs are sustaining other sorts of cuts in the context of our overall budgeting environment. The OHSU already heavily subsidizes those public missions and with clinical revenue, and although we've said that in a sprinkling of ways, I wanted to make sure I underscored it here, and I'll mention it again when you see the specific numbers. But that subsidy has continuously increased over time. Now, this is a graph of the state appropriation to the operating budget. This graph does not include the debt service. A subsequent graph will. But this is the amount of the state appropriation, and you saw another version of this with the same numbers from Mr. Bender last week. I want to point out in the context of the comments and the framework principles that I just mentioned, that if you look at the revenue growth over time, in the middle, roughly, of this graph, you see the 1995 plateau, which is essentially where we were when the public corporation was enacted. And we were at a stage where we were essentially unable to grow given the constraints of the structure we were in. The public corporation really allowed us to access the debt market, to access capital in order to renovate our patient care facilities and thereby compete effectively in the patient care market. This in turn, because of the structure of healthcare, and we'll go over this in more detail in President Kohler's testimony, and it's also covered in the white paper in response to Senator Gordley's request, allows you to cost shift. And if you cost shift, you can carry a larger proportion, or not a larger proportion, but a larger absolute number of patients who can't afford to pay for health care. So the ability to grow the commercial side of the patient care program at OHSU is absolutely essential to the ability to carry patients who cannot afford to pay. This is a pie chart. You've seen this before. It just shows the relative amounts of revenue for this current fiscal year. You can see a little more than half is made up of patient care revenue. And the tuition, which is blue, and the state appropriation, which is green, are roughly comparable in terms of their support of the educational mission. The priorities for developing a budget in the context of the governor's recommended appropriation had several principles applied. The first is more of a characteristic of our whole budget, and that is that the choices of how to distribute this cut are very limited. They're limited to the places the state appropriation is expended. To some extent, their grants and contracts, of course, can't be moved around. They have to be expended for whatever the grant was awarded to do. Patient care revenue, you have a little more flexibility, but obviously you have to deliver the patient care. So in the course of delivering patient care, the hospital essentially hires faculty in the School of Medicine to deliver that patient care, and you'll hear more about that in President Kohler's testimony, but in a sense that helps support the School of Medicine. In addition, they actually pay a tax, the physicians do, to the school in support of the educational mission, and you'll see those numbers. The capital and operating budgets is perhaps the most confusing thing about any major budget, and the distinction between those two is very important. The operating budget's obviously the budget that determines the revenues and expenses of your basic operation. The capital budget consists of one-time expenditures for major items of equipment, construction, renovation, and they're prescribed in a very specific way by accounting regulations and by analysts who look at our debt worthiness and so on. And they're essential to deliver the revenue of the operating budget. And what happened in 1995 is that when we became a public corporation, we assumed all of our debt from higher ed. It was transferred to us, and you saw some of those numbers last time. In addition, we were able to access the capital market in order to invest in upgrading the hospital facility and some additional facilities, but most of the revenue bonds have gone into the hospital facility. Each year, we develop a capital budget as well as an operating budget and take it to our board. We also also have a five-year plan for our operating and capital budget, and we're in the process right now of upgrading the last five-year plan, which is finishing now to go forward for the next 5 years. And that has the major capital projects in it and an operating plan that will generate enough cash to finance those capital projects. And so the two have to work very closely together so that you can sustain both the cash to generate the operating, the capital budget, but also so that capital is invested appropriately to generate the revenue for the operating budget. Does that make sense? It's sort of an interlocking set of budgets that have to operate together. In setting the priorities for the program Mr. reductions...
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Just one question about the constraints. The one category you don't mention in this particular slide are the gifts. Can you talk about what the parameters are
there
and how you're restricted or not?
It depends on the gift. And so each gift comes with a set of restrictions determined by the donor. We wish that we had more in the category that were not restricted, but there are virtually none in that category. So gifts are almost always restricted for something. The majority of the gifts to OHSU are restricted to a specific research area. It might be Parkinson's or MS or cancer. There are a few that are restricted for student support. Usually those take the form of scholarships. So we have scholarship funds that are donor designated. We have a variety of research support. Occasionally, and unfortunately it's all too rare, there will be one that's in general support of the educational mission. And that will endow perhaps a faculty member or a position in the dean's office in support of the educational mission. We have a few of those. Each one of those is, of course, goes into whatever mission the donor has designated. So in general, most of the gifts are in the restricted category as we spend them because we don't have the discretion. Every once in a while, we'll have a discretionary one, but it's a very small amount of money.
Thank you. That clarifies the parameters on the total category of gifts, grants, and contracts. Thank you.
In looking at the governor's recommended budget, we had to make a set of very difficult decisions. The first one we made, and it's really a fundamental decision that affects everything else, was that we would protect the educational infrastructure in our schools. And in particular here, we're talking about medicine, dentistry, and nursing because those are the schools that receive state funding. And as Mr. Bender explained to you very nicely in that report on Wednesday, there are no state dollars in the Oregon Graduate Institute School of Science and Engineering. So that's why we're talking about those three schools in particular. Now, we could have made a different decision. We could have recommended closure of one of the schools, and we did not do that. We are recommending to you that, given the workforce shortages that we face, that the best thing we could recommend is to try and sustain the strength and quality of those three schools in such a way that hopefully in the future we'll be able to build on that and build that capacity. So that was the first thing we did, was to try and protect the three schools. The second thing is kind of an overarching principle in general, and that is that we have to keep an eye toward self-sustaining the institution. If we start undermining the ability for the institution to support itself, we'll spiral down very rapidly. So in every decision, we had to look at the revenue impact as well as the service reduction impact. And then in the context of those two sort of framing principles, the goal was in each decision to maximize the amount of care that could be provided for the most vulnerable. Now, and what does that mean? In several instances, it means protecting match funding some state money is leveraged to bring in federal money. CDRC is a great example of that. We protected in its entirety the program that brings in Title V federal dollars through the Health Division, which delivers care to 10,000 children statewide. That program has not been touched in these recommendations. Unfortunately, what that means is that there are a series of clinics on the Hill that require a state subsidy to operate, and you heard a lot of testimony to that effect from patients of those clinics, that we will not be able to sustain if there's not restoration of that budget. And there are some other aspects to this maximization of care for vulnerable or reduction of debt to students, such as loan forgiveness and scholarship programs as well. So those are the principles that we've used as a sort of framework and filter. And I'm going to skip through a couple of these slides.
Thank you. I think this is one of the things that some of the committee members are concerned about. I mean, how did you pick those priorities? I mean, you've got the three core principles. But the testimony I've heard, you know, the CDRC has been a very emotional and compelling case. And so couldn't you have chosen something else? I've heard that question answered.
Sure.
I think Senator Walker really has a concern about that.
Right.
Why did you not keep CDRC? Because that's such an important program.
Right.
So I don't know how we can clarify that.
Well, it's a hard thing to do. We did protect the part of CDRC, as I say, that leveraged the most care for the most children. We, in the recommended budget, if you look at the detail, we took 100% of the state funding out of the hospital. Now, that's a terrible thing to do, but the alternative would have been to take more out of the CDRC. So in order to maximize the protection of children, in essence, and families with special health care needs, we actually forced the hospital to deliver as much care for the poor as it possibly could without any state support. So when we prioritized, we were at the point to protect, we took all the money out of the hospital, we took part of the money out of CDRC, but protected the statewide programs that serve the most kids. The next thing we could have done, the next choice, would have been to close the rural health programs altogether, and then we wouldn't have been able to build them back. As it is, we've pretty much decimated them in this budget, but what we have left is the federal requirements to have an AHEC so that we could add back over time if we were forced to take that reduction. The other alternative would be to close one of the schools. So those were the trade-offs we were facing, and so what we tried to do, as I say, is to protect. We reduced a lot of funding from the schools, but we tried to protect their existence and quality. So those are the trade-offs that we faced. And the hospital was sort of the lever, and it ended up with no money. That's why we ended up, and still it wasn't enough to meet the target. I don't know if that helps. But.
Thank you.
We were asked as part of this budget presentation to give you the actual revenues of all the units. You've seen this slide before. This is a color graphic depiction of that. The answer to that, in under tab 6, you will find, and I'll come to it in a moment, much more detail. What I want to do now is just skip through this rather quickly, and unless you have questions. One of the questions was what has happened over the last 15 years, and this table summarizes that, and I won't belabor it. You're all familiar with the Measure 5 impacts. The cuts were actually 10, 20, and 15% in three successive biennia off of the rolled-up, in those days everything was off of the rolled-up budget, and so the corporate fiscal, because they're very accurate, has reduced that 95 to 97 to the actual reduction because it was 15% off the rolled-up budget. We didn't do that on the previous ones because this starts with a public corporation in terms of our own records here. But I think what the point of this is that we went through all three of those biennia with no program reductions. We were able to trim administration, to do everything we could to find efficiencies, and without reducing any degree-granting programs. When we went in and when we formed the public corporation, we agreed to not to come back in 97 and ask for more money, but to sustain those programs with flat funding, and that we would go for 4 years, and we did. In 99, we asked for an inflationary increase, and we received about that amount. It was $4 million, and but it was not an inflationary increase. It was, in fact, allocated to dentistry, nursing, and the AHEC, which were, in fact, the three programs most dependent on state dollars. So there was a logic to that. It did, however, leave 71% of the budget with no increase. Since then, we've received a number of reductions, and I'll talk about those in the next slide, but we were left at that point with no choice but to reduce programs because we have done all the trimming, we've gained enormous efficiencies, but the continued reductions have required corresponding program reductions. in the biennium, and here I've condensed the 2001-03 and the 2003-05 biennium into single slides for the requested look back of 4 years. And I'm not going to go through the details of this. I will just highlight a couple of things. In the first biennium in the AHEC programs, we eliminated a variety of sort of support areas for everything other than medicine. The medical rural rotation was protected in that set of cuts, but some of the other health areas were not protected, weren't able to be protected. In dentistry, and you'll hear this theme again and again, they increased tuition depending. It was 15% resident and 20% non-resident in that particular year. And we closed the dental hygiene program. Not something we wanted to do, but in fact, other institutions do provide education for dental hygiene. We weren't the only one who did. We were the only dental school, and so what we tried to do is protect the core of the dental school and close the dental hygiene. Now, we're collaborating with others. Pacific University is trying to start one up. Their board's approved that, and they're working through that. We're collaborating with them on giving them materials, sites, clinical sites, and so on, and we've been collaborating with the community colleges as well. In the next biennia, again, there were significant reductions, and you can see the items, again, another tuition increase in dentistry and some infrastructure reduction as you go through these. I'll show you the graphs of revenue for nursing so you can kind of visually see how they accommodated, but we had to downsize some of the rural frontier programs, which are very costly per student. I'm happy to report we've been able to obtain federal grants to restore those subsequently, so that's a sort of happy story, but tuition increases have occurred in nursing, not at as high a level as they have in dentistry and medicine, but they have. And then in the reductions in the last session, we eliminated half a dozen nursing degree granting programs that had very tiny enrollments and consolidated them into a broader scope of practice degree and family practice.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Whitson.
Mr. Devlin, Ms. Halleck, in view of these reductions, and you compare them with OHSU consolidated net income, this particular graph that you've given us, it's rather a bizarre financial picture. But I can understand that in 01-02 and 02-03, where you had a net operating loss of $7 million roughly, that you'd be cutting programs. But then again in 304, you have a net income of $21 million, and in 05, $31.3 million. Two questions. One is, how do you what do you use those net profits for? And the second question is, what are your projected net consolidated income for the 06-07 years?
That is all contained in the subsequent slides, but I'm happy to at least address it briefly here, and then if you would let me come to that, I will. Basically, we have a negative reserve on the university side and a positive on the hospital, just because, as you'll see, that we generate a loss on the university side and a positive net on the hospital. The hospital is generally used to carry the loss on the university side and to invest in the capital that it needs to replace its facilities and grow its facilities so that it can carry both the educational mission as well as the care for the poor that it sustains. It sustains in, for example, this year, approximately a $40 million loss on the care for the poor. It's offset by its net commercial payer positive gain, which then flows to the School of Medicine and subsidizes it. And you'll see a lot of those dollars as we go through the specifics of the budget. So the bottom line here is that when there is a net positive, it is used either to subsidize the parts of the university that are negative or, in fact, to invest in the capital to sustain the institution so that it can continue to provide a positive cash flow and care for the poor. The care for the poor aspect of the hospital is an extremely important part of this equation. So,
Mr. Chair, I guess my confusion is this is the OHSU consolidated net income, and I'm a little at a loss. Shouldn't those allocations have already been made before you come to this figure?
Yeah, it is confusing. The net income refers to the income statement, the operating budget. So it's the net income of the operating budget. that net income is what funds the capital budget. And so it isn't net of the amount of cash that's invested in the construction or the equipment. Even simple things like the library collection are in the capital budget. So
this figure, 31.3 million or whatever it will be next year, you have discretion as whether you invest that in capital construction or whether you supplement other programs with it.
We have some discretion. If, however, we don't fund the capital budget, we wouldn't be able to stay in operation. So we don't have the discretion of not funding the capital budget if we want to stay in business, because then you can't replace equipment as it becomes unusable.
It becomes a matter of priority,
you know,
then, doesn't it?
What's that?
It becomes a matter of priority then.
It does, and priority to operate. I mean, the priority is necessary to stay in operation.
Thank you.
Sure.
Representative Jensen had it.
Thank you. Could you be specific in what master's degree programs were eliminated?
Yes.
And as a follow-up, is there a direct relationship between that and the reduction in faculty?
There was, although it wasn't direct, it was indirect. A number of faculty, because of when the School of Nursing started, had reached the retirement age. And so we happened to have a fairly significant cohort of faculty retire, and we didn't replace them all. So that was one of the ways we absorbed it. Now, where were they? Some of them were in these programs that were eliminated. Some were not, in which case we had to move faculty around to make sure that we covered the right programs. To answer your question of which programs were eliminated, we took specialty programs. They were nurse practitioner programs, and they tended to have an age specificity to them. So they were programs for adults or programs for children. And what we did is we allowed all those students to finish, if they so chose, and any applicants to move their application into family nurse practitioner programs, which have a broader scope of practice across the whole age spectrum. And every one of the applicants elected to do that. So we didn't actually lose a single applicant. What we did is we took a number of specialty programs that had maybe 10 or 12 students a year in them and eliminated them and went to a broader scope of practice general program, which was more popular with the students anyway. There was one, the geriatric program, which we didn't close. We actually moved it to Ashland because there was a tremendous strength of faculty in the nursing program there in geriatrics and actually a fairly significant retired population. So we were able to save that program by moving it, essentially.
Well, it was a geriatric program that I was going to looking at the representative might tell you why there's some interest in that, but also looking at the demographics of the state of Oregon and looking at the prognosis for getting health care costs under control in the United States as well as just the state of Oregon, it would strike me that the nurse practitioner in geriatrics is probably, if we're going to be far thinking in our thing here, one of the most important areas that we could and should be looking at.
We completely agree, and we had one applicant for the program that year in Portland. But in Ashland, I'm happy to report we've had a robust applicant pool, and we have a very strong faculty. We brought in a number of grants to the area to help finance that program. So, in fact, the move strengthened it. The other thing that's happened, though, to help the Portland area is that these programs communicate via distance ed. So there's a lot of geriatric teaching from the faculty at Southern that actually is delivered to Portland. So that's how we tried to strengthen that program. But we were worried about it also, and we were delighted when we were able to save it that way.
Thank you. Sure. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Medicine, again, is a tuition story. We've increased the tuition. We've rolled it in that case, class by class, which means the freshmen would be paying more than seniors in the first year, and then it rolls in through the subsequent 3 years. We've also increased the number of non-residents in medicine, and one of the questions last time was to bring those, and I have those provided in this material, the various percentages of residents and non-residents in each class will come to when we get to the end. We increased the class size. This was a stretch for the faculty, but because of the shortage, we very much have wanted to increase the medical school class. And we also admitted some additional students to the third year so that we could really ramp it up more rapidly. Allied Health, we've been kind of eliminating. Essentially, we formed partnerships with other institutions that deliver Allied Health undergraduate education. We have a delightful partnership with OIT where they deliver the medical technology program on our campus. So it really didn't move. Continues to do all its internships in our laboratories. The EMT is an even more delightful partnership. That's a three-way partnership with the Tualatin Valley Fire District. They employ 120 EMTs, and at their training center, we have a three-way partnership with OIT and the Tualatin Valley Fire District. So we are no longer administratively or financially carrying that program, but we participate. We provide medical directorship and training sites. CDRC, I won't go through the detail here.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
I note on the 0305, you, in the back, in the slide there, that we reduced patient services and faculty income. I assume we're talking salaries here. Is that...
We are.
I don't know what you were paying faculty. I don't know what you're paying them now. And that's not the issue or question I have. The concern I have with this is how close, when you start doing this, when do you approach the your inability to recruit those faculty that you most need and want?
It's a grave concern to us, and we follow it very closely, and I can't say we always call it exactly the right way, but what we have done over the last 15 years is ask our faculty to essentially raise their own salaries at some point and try and reimburse that portion of their time they spend teaching with either tuition or state revenue. But at some point, you're asking them to do more and more for less and less, and they leave. And so we're always on that balance of they want to be there because they believe in the mission. But at some point you cross over the line where they're recruitable, and we're at that point, and it really we have people on the road literally right now, so we're very very mindful of that risk.
It strikes me, excuse me, Mr. Chair, but it strikes me that, I mean, you've done two things here to create a less competitive place for faculty. One is you've increased their workload with 10 more students per class.
Right.
And two, there's been something of a reduction in their income.
Right.
And I just personally would be concerned that no trend of this nature, because I think it's going to be counterproductive, and we're going to lose that competitive advantage and all the other things that, you know, start to play in there. And I realize that a lot of people will complain about the amount of money that people make, and, you know, that's fine. But
thank you. We agree.
You know, if I might just interject, we are already losing people. We're losing, you asked about psychiatry in particular, we're probably losing the best geriatric psychiatrist that we have in the state. He's going to the University of Vermont. He had grant support for 70% of his salary, and it was the uncertainty of this budget that tipped him over to leave. We had his going away reception last week. There are other people looking as well. Now, we are recruiting as part of the Oregon Opportunity. That's not over. But there is a risk there of getting just too close and not being able to hang on to people who are going to be important to the state in the future.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's testimony that we need to really be cognizant of as we look at this particular budget, because as long as it is a premier institution, as long as it is and continues to provide the service and generate the income and the revenue, and you know that it is currently doing, we can't do things, if that's important to us for it to do that, we can't do things that are going to make it less able to fulfill that mission. So
I addressed CDRC earlier in a general sense, and we'll come back at the end to the specifics, but for the look back of 4+ years, I just wanted to let you know that we have trimmed around the edges here. As you heard last week, there was a line budget for CDRC for many years. We've really sustained those appropriation levels, and they've taken their share of the cuts, but not additional cuts. And these are the kinds of things that they did in the previous biennia to try and accommodate that. So they've already made a lot of adjustments that were less drastic than the ones in the governor's recommended budget, but these have been done now. And so there weren't a lot of sort of low-hanging fruit kinds of choices. Not that these were that, but they did less harm, any one of them, than the ones we're now facing. Hospitals and clinics is really a restructuring, and these words don't do it justice. It's a massive restructuring of hospitals and clinics. They have continued to face the challenges in the market and have continued to be able to produce, in essence, the net bottom line that carries the university. So there's lots that I could say here, but in the interest of time, I can't really, but I would be happy to talk to you separately about that. I want to make the point, because it's part of the discussion about how you accommodate reductions, that indeed we have raised tuition, and in the last bar on this graph, if the governor's recommended budget were implemented, we would be raising it yet again. But if you look at the height of these curves, you can see that they have not gone up overall in aggregate, and yet the cost of these programs have gone up. And to illustrate that and to understand exactly how students are funded at OHSU and what it costs to educate different groups, we've developed a capitation model. And that capitation model is a really in-depth analysis of what it costs for each kind of student. We've implemented it the first year of the last two biennia. And so we've looked at the total cost of students from all sources and all expenditures in terms of the educational mission in the 02 fiscal year and the 04 fiscal year. So those yellow blips on top of the 02 and 04 bars that I just showed you represent the component of the educational mission in medicine, dentistry, and nursing that the university funds by transfers essentially from other monies that it finds or is able to obtain. Some of it is from training grants, federal training grants. Some of it is from the clinical revenue that is transferred, as I discussed earlier. And so these, as you can see, a significant proportion of the increases in the cost of the educational mission that have occurred over time are borne by the university and not by the students. But there is still a component that the students bear in increased tuition.
Can you clarify again why that university contribution is not shown in the other years?
It is there, and you could draw a line. We could project it. The reason it's not is that this is an extremely precise analysis. This has to do with the compulsive nature of Irene Barheit and I, the assistant comptroller. We have not actually gone in and looked at every single expenditure in the university and determined was that for an educational purpose, a research purpose, or a clinical purpose. The data is there, and it is accounted for in that way. But the analysis at that level of detail, literally every expenditure in every school, was done in detail in every other year is how we've decided to do it. So these numbers are absolutely precise. You could project, and with great confidence, that the number between in 03 would be in between those two. So that the expenditures are there, and it is a little confusing to depict it this way. So the revenue sources by units are in detail under tab 6. I'm just going to show you the graphs of two of them, nursing and CDRC. You saw medicine last week. But I want to point out that before we ever start the governor's recommended budget discussions, you can see a very large difference. These are annual budgets between 2000 and 2004. Now, this basically represents the first biennium, the first annual budget in 2004 of the current biennium. The 2005 looks very similar. And what you can see is the green, the state appropriation, has reduced over time, and it has been picked up by a variety of other sources, research sources, gifts, grants, and tuition. But you can see that tuition has not picked up a disproportionate amount. In fact, it's picked up very little of that increase in nursing. We've really tried to limit the increases as much as we possibly could. CDRC, you can see that the state appropriation to CDRC was reduced. Now, this is before the reductions in the current discussion, by 50%. And they've made that up, essentially, in both grant funding and clinical revenue. But those things, of course, don't fund the exact same activities. So, again, there were all those shifts that I showed you on the previous slide, just to give you a feel for what we've been doing to make up these cuts as best we could to try and protect the integrity of those programs. And if you do the same thing for 05 and 06, and this begins to get at the question that Senator Whitsitt asked, the attached spreadsheet under tab 6 really goes through the detail of every single unit, 05 and as we currently project 06. If you want the detail, I again have just picked out nursing and CDRC for illustration purposes to show you what we see changing between 05 and 06. And we see the green, which is the state appropriation, reduced somewhat. Again, we try to protect the core of these schools, but in the case of a $32.8 million reduction, we couldn't take no money from nursing and still meet that target. We've increased tuition significantly here because we did not want to reduce the production of nurse graduates because of the shortage. And as near as we can tell, the applicant pool is still strong. Now, we are not far enough along to see the acceptances. We do expect that we will lose students when it comes to the acceptance. They're sort of watching to see if there's going to be relief to this tuition increase. The CDRC, now their proposed 06 budget does include some revenue enhancements, some revenue transfers. There were clinics we were able to protect. You didn't hear from those patients, of course, but for example, the cleft palate clinic, we originally thought we were going to have to close because it requires a substantial subsidy to operate. Our faculty have stepped up to the plate there, and the surgeons and some of the specialists have offered to provide care for free to these kids. That's how we made it work. So we've been able to save that program, which we originally thought we were going to have to close if this budget were implemented. So wherever we can, we've tried to find revenue solutions or expense reduction solutions. But there are a half a dozen programs that you've seen and you will see in the impact slides that we have not been able to find such a magic bullet in order to save in the face of this order of magnitude of reduction. This is just to remind you that under tab 6 you can actually see this, which right now I realize you can't. But this gives you the complete story of the various sources of revenue in each of these units and how they're funded and how we see that they will be funded in 06. Of course, this is a projection, but it really lays out all the funding sources in each program. And if you want detail or if you want us to meet with you individually on any one of these, of course, we're happy to do that.
Sure.
Yes. Yeah.
Are these list of these? There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Is this the entire headings of where the $70 million or $100 million is spent?
Yes.
They're all within this category.
The state money is in fact in the top entities and the hospital and poison center. So in the middle there where you see research institutes and other, where you see under the state appropriations column, that first column you see the dashes. There's no state money there.
Okay.
But that state appropriation, $42.889 million, is in fact the entirety of the state appropriation to OHSU. So it gives you the complete allocation.
Okay. Can I clarify that?
Sure.
In 05 and then 06, it's showing state appropriations. This is my geriatric portion with the best eyeglasses that can be bought.
Yeah, I apologize. It could be a bigger number version. I have the same problem.
About $42 million in 05 and looks like 36. Well, geez.
26.
26.5.
Yeah. So is this the... the total governor's budget is
53.
So the difference between the two
is 1 year versus two. This is an annual budget,
right?
And so the governor's 53 is a biennial budget,
right? but we're showing a total of 42 and 26 here.
Oh, I'm sorry. 05 is the current year.
Oh, okay.
So it's in this biennium, and so it's half of 85, basically, which was the appropriation for the 2003-2005 biennium. Yeah. Starting July 1, we'd be in the next biennium, so the 06 budget, which starts next July 1, is the we've shown with the governors.
Just the basis for the confusion is we would refer to the coming budget as the 05 biennium.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You're right. I should have said the first year of the 05-07 biennium.
Okay.
But yes, it's just that first year of the next biennium.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, Mr. Bender has a question.
Excuse me. I just had a question. I noticed that you're showing your total unrestricted revenue growing from about $914 million to $918 million. Which is a very slow rate of growth. I was wondering if you're just trying to be prudent and not overestimate revenues, or whether you really think that there's going to be essentially no revenue growth.
Well, you know, of course there is a degree of conservatism in any budgeting process, because you don't want to overstate your revenue. And in fact, it's tempting for units to come in and state a revenue solution to avoid cutting, and we push back if we don't think it's realistic of them to generate that revenue. But the fact is, with the kind of reductions that would be proposed in this budget, there are also revenue hits. And so the combination of the revenue reductions and the other pressures that the institution is on, we think this is about what we can generate. Now, of course, we'd love to be able to generate more, but based on our current, now, none of the new buildings open until either partway or all the way through this year. So we don't have the capacity to generate more revenue until 07, really, when the new facilities come online. So that's the other thing that's holding it back here, is we aren't into the new buildings yet.
Yes.
Along that line, so you're looking at what, a 6-7% reduction in gift grants and contracts. Is there something in there that we should know about? I mean, the question is why a reduction in those?
Yeah, it depends on which unit you look at there.
I'm looking at the totals.
So. Right, I understand, and I'm just trying to point out some of the difference. And I think some of that may be the Oregon Opportunity money coming over. Is that right, Irene? The Oregon Opportunity comes into our books as a gift, as a grant, as a restricted revenue source.
Oh,
and
okay.
There's quite a bit of it flowing through right now, both for the construction but also for the recruitment, and those hit the operating statement. So some of that is just the reduction of those monies coming in. Other questions?
Oh, yes. Representative March.
There's been a question raised. A lot of the revenue is patient care, things like that. And the question is, why are we dealing with it in education other than it's a historical artifact? Right. Is that the reason?
Well, I suppose that is the reason. We were part of the higher ed system, of course, from really since our inception in 1887. 1974, we became a freestanding university, but until 1995, we're part of higher ed. So our budget always came through there. There is another component of the budget, a fairly modest one, but there is some of the patient revenue, the Medicare reimbursement, Medicaid reimbursement. It isn't an appropriation. It's a purchase service, and I think Mr. Bender described that would come through the health service side. But our appropriation historically has come this way. Certainly in the case of CDRC and hospital, you're absolutely right. I mean, the kinds of things they deliver are more akin to the health services.
Yes.
In years past, there was Medicaid overpayment level reimbursements that we got back. Are the good old days gone?
Unfortunately, they are. And you'll see when President Kohler testifies some very specific aspects to that. But those rates have continued to decline. And there was a period when Medicare patients actually generated net positive. And there was even a year when Medicaid patients did. But those are definitely gone.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. The net income, I've reiterated, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but we did go over this last time. There have been significant losses on the part of the university. There was a period in 99 and 2000 that had to do with consolidation with the foundation when the market was really chugging along, and we actually had some net positive there. But then in the post 9/11 world, there was the opposite effect in terms of the ability of the foundation consolidation to help the institution's income statement. We have been rapidly trying to recover the costs of the university, and with stricter and stricter budgeting, basically the goal is to bring the university to a net zero. The hospital, which is a lighter blue on top of this, is really how we balance all that, and you can see from the line the net income of the consolidation of the two. So the hospital really is the generator of the revenue right now, but we have to be very mindful of its ability to do that as the reimbursements drop.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So you mentioned the consolidation with the foundation, and the foundation, I presume, has investments. And so you're showing then some of the loss as paper losses of the foundation. Is that correct?
There is a correction that you have to do in that consolidation that is paper. So when we're managing, and the income statements that we've submitted, and in fact they're in a tab in your notebook, really show all those. So if you look up to the net revenue and expenses in those operating statements, you will see before the foundation that correction what the operating budget is, and that's kind of what we manage to and what the board holds us to is that operational net. But the income statement that the accounting rules, GASB accounting rules, require is this consolidation. Did you want to say something?
Well, I was just going to say, in terms of the consolidation with the foundation, it helps us from accounting purposes, but it's not money you can spend either way, when it goes up or when it goes down. So, on the other hand, we would wish that the foundation would be able to give us more real unrestricted money along the lines of the question you asked, Senator Gordley.
The fundraising has been difficult in the last few years. We have raised the amount we pledged we would as part of the Oregon Opportunity, but there has not been the production of discretionary revenue that could have helped us on the operational side. This is probably
yes. Question?
Senator Walker.
Dr. Hallett, could you tell me if the research dollars are paying for itself? Are you going in the hole with your research dollars?
The research dollars pay for all but about 8 to 10% of the total cost of research. The rest is really made up out of that clinical revenue. In the slide where I showed the two yellow bars on the student side, that makes up most of the most of the academic transfers that come from the clinical side. The balance that they transfer, and there is more that they transfer, really supports the research component. It's a fairly modest amount, but there is a slight support that the faculty, out of their own salaries, they take it out of their income, the physicians do, out of the 501c3, and they help support usually starting investigators. That's the kind of thing where they maybe don't have a grant yet for the first year. Recruitment package in the department, those are the two most common things that the practitioners in a department will actually fund out of their pocket to help the next generation of faculty get started and to help their department grow its research agenda. So there is that infrastructure support that comes in from the practice group.
So, Mr. Chair, can I follow up?
Yes.
So if I'm understanding the 8 to 10% that research doesn't pay for itself, then the clinics make up for the difference as well as the dean's tax?
Not the clinics, but in fact the clinical revenue, the personal clinical revenue of the physicians. That's really the principal transfer that occurs. The hospital itself sustains the institution, but the research program in the departments that isn't recovered by grants, and it's very small, but that portion, the 8 to 10%, is really out of the pockets of the physicians, out of the 501c3, their practice income, that they put the dean's tax in the dean's office for the educational mission, and then they put a portion into the department. Some of that pays for education as well, and a little bit of it pays for research.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Dr. Hallett, one question that I had, and it's not apparent on your slides, it's just a general area. You're also in a business. How competitive is the hospital market in the Portland metropolitan area?
Well, that's a great question. We have become increasingly competitive as a result of some of the facilities investments we've done. It's absolutely critical that we are competitive in order to sustain the revenue to support the public mission. So it's something we watch all the time. You want to say something?
Yeah. We are living in a very fortunate time right now in terms of hospital competition. Because of the ceiling on hospital beds for so long and the lack of new beds coming online, Portland has also been growing. We have been establishing a I think, more and more attractive and appropriate environment for health care. But as hospital beds open around the region, there is some concern we'll be once again overbedded or not. I think it's important to keep the quality of our services very high so that we can continue to be able to attract the patients who can pay to support those who cannot.
Please proceed.
I have here to answer a specific request included the capital budgets for fiscal year 05, the one we're in now, and fiscal year 06, which is the first year of the next biennium. So I apologize if this has the same kind of element of confusion as the operating budgets. But so it's the last year of the biennium we're just finishing, and the first year of the next one is what we're showing here. And if you fight through the detail of this, what it really lists are all the construction projects that we're building, and we're at the end in 06 and the first part of 07 of a fairly major investment in three facilities, some by OHSU, some by the practice group, and some by the Oregon Opportunity Bonds, and they're all depicted on here, at least the OHSU part of the South Waterfront building. The three-fourths of the South Waterfront building is, as I mentioned last time, is really owned by and financed by the practice group, and that does not appear on OHSU's books. In addition to the specific major projects that are shown here for both the university and the hospital, there is an ongoing operating capital budget that defines, that supports things like equipment purchased in the departments or the central service programs, computer applications that are purchased. The library collection is a capital item, as it turns out, so just the periodical subscription. Facilities, but also any equipment that has to be replaced. And all of that is funded by a combination of bonds and cash. And we're facing a period, in fact, we spent several hours with our board finance and audit committee last week going over this. We're facing a period where we're extremely challenged in terms of our ability to generate cash for the next 2 years. They're concerned and tracking this very, very closely in terms of how we fund, continue and finish each of these projects. It'll be tight. We will undoubtedly end up with an 06 budget, which will be finalized for our June board meeting, with less of our routine capital than is indicated here. I think when we finish the budget process, we're right in the middle of it right now for 06, we will be forced, because of the tightness of the budget, to reduce the amount of cash that we're able to put into routine investments in capital replacements. I've listed on the next couple of slides what some of those items are to give you. This is just a limited list. The lists are pages long, but to try and give you a sense of what some of the major items are that are on those, and they tend to be replacing ICU beds. Those are very high technology kinds of rooms, or fitting them out in the case of the new patient care facility. The pediatric ICU beds, PICU they're called in our jargon, also have extremely expensive instrumentation. The MRI technology is in need of upgrading. Those are in the budget for 06, as are other kinds of imaging equipment. There are also a variety of things that are being done on an ongoing basis that are required by JACO, which is the accreditation group that accredits hospitals, and a series of them are required by that sort of process or by university accreditation. That's a smaller amount. account, or by the requirements of this legislation known as HIPAA, which is really a privacy legislation for patient care, but requires huge information system investments to secure that privacy. So there's a variety of items on that, and then I've listed some of the routine budget items in here as well, and both the technology and then in mission critical areas. So I haven't listed them all by any means, but we've tried to give you a little feel for what's in that capital budget item that isn't specific for a construction project. I'm going to, if you allow me, I'm going to skip through the next section very quickly because I think it's self-explanatory. It was in response to specific instructions in the Phase 2 material, but they basically are accountability factors that describe our planning process, how we go through financial planning. I've already touched on some of that. And what sort of environment we're in. Again, we're touching on that as we go in terms of some of the pressures on our financial planning. And then what some of the kind of accountability and compliance issues are that apply to our operation on a regular basis. So Sarbanes-Oxley, you probably heard about the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. It really applies to private corporations, but many nonprofits and, in fact, public corporations are looking through their processes, their procedures, their accountability practices to make sure that they're doing things in the best possible way. We've just been through an intense review of those practices with Sarbanes-Oxley in mind and found that we were actually in remarkably good shape. There are a few little things we decided to implement as a result of that review, but it found us in good stead should Sarbanes-Oxley subsequently be applied to other forms of organization, which we all expect will be the case. We also have an extensive integrity program that's been really bolstered the last 4 years, and I can talk to you about any aspect of that you would like. We have, in addition, an internal audit process as well as our annual external audits that we use both for fiscal purposes but also for operational purposes to make sure that we're doing things in the best possible way, and we have a planning process that determines where those audits will be directed in the coming years. Now, there's a little segment in here on the sort of revenue side of this equation, the self-sustaining ability of OHSU to generate the revenue to deliver the missions in education and research and in clinical care. And I'm not going to spend any time on those because we touched on them in Phase 1, but they're in here should you want to refer to sort of the economic impact of OHSU and the taxes that OHSU pays. We pay over $161 million in payroll taxes each year. 31.8 of those go into the general fund in the form of income taxes. And then you can see how it spreads after that. We bring in about $27 for each dollar that the state invests in OHSU. There's a little bit of a summary in here, and I'm just about right on time, so I'm going to spend just 1 minute going over it in terms of the Oregon opportunity. Again, we gave you a pretty extensive report of the Oregon opportunity in Phase 1. The Oregon opportunity on the public side was a $200 million bond issue that allowed us to invest in research infrastructure. This is the way those monies have been and are being spent. Half of them are in the new research building, which will open this next fall and allow us to house some of the people we've already recruited and the additional people that will be recruited. In addition, it's provided and is still providing some of the recruitment packages for those individuals, as well as for a facility on the West Campus that, again, has biomedical engineering and some of the other sort of computer science-oriented research in it. The rural, and there's a little bit of a return on investment that Senator Devlin requested here, which gives you a feel for some of those recruitment packages. We've hired so far 64 of the original 71 forecast. We're still have several years to go in this forecast, so we're well ahead of schedule. We have 29 additional recruitments that are budgeted and committed. Either the individuals are signed up or their senior investigator who's recruiting them is signed up. So we're really already committed beyond beyond the 71, and very pleased with the way we've been able to leverage and utilize those funds. Just two examples of the ROI kind of a consideration. The vaccine and gene therapy investment over the entire business plan is about $5.8 million. To date, they've already brought in, received more than $12 million in grants. They have 9 patent applications and 2 spinoff companies. So, and this is very early on in the business plan. Anesthesiology, now that's not one you just a priori would have predicted would be a big research recruitment, but we were able to essentially steal an incredibly strong anesthesiology team from Johns Hopkins, and they've received over $5 million in grants already, so they've already more than doubled the investment that we've made. And I think at that point you've already seen this. I'd like to stop talking about the Oregon opportunity and say just a very brief word about the South Waterfront. This is in response to questions that came up last time, and also is part of the sort of self-sustaining aspect of what we're doing. This is a picture of the hill, and I chose just this picture to give you a sense of why we're doing this. The hill is very constrained in terms of how many buildings and how much capacity you can put on there, and mostly by the road system, actually. We've gotten rather good at building across canyons, but there's no way to get there. And so if we're going to continue to grow and carry the capacity of both the research effort, the economic development stimulus, and the care for the poor, we have to grow the clinical enterprise and ultimately the research enterprise. And so the city really wanted us to serve as an anchor tenant in the South Waterfront District. And it's a very strategic location once the concept of a tram was invoked, because the streetcar from Portland State comes down there, and we were able to tie the campus together with a single concept of a campus. The investment has been rather minimal on the part of OHSU. We are 25% owners in Building 1. The practice group is a 75% owner. There's been over $300 million dollars worth of property that have been added to the tax rolls by the private investment of the developers in the housing projects to date. They're more than 80% sold. The public sector, in particular, with strong support from Portland Development Commission, Portland Department of Transportation, the Parks Group, federal funds, and the very strong support of the federal delegation, and Oregon Department of Transportation have really helped with the infrastructure of the transportation. We have 2 parcels down there that were, and it's really the central district that we're developing now. The second was donated by the Schnitzer family, and that has not yet been developed. There's a little bit of detail in here about the first building that's under construction, that is this building I described. It will have the outpatient clinics of the medical group there, some education and research, including the OSU College of Pharmacy that's currently located on the hill, and the biomedical engineering program that's currently out on the West Campus. And then the tram, there was a question about how the tram is financed. The tram is really part of the transportation system as a whole. And those projects are funded by a variety of mechanisms that are sort of self-sustaining. They're not funded out of our general university budget. They are funded by a combination of public investment. The delegates, as I say, have been very supportive of bringing infrastructure dollars out of the federal transportation, as have been the local and the state transportation infrastructure entities. But a big part of this is the property value of that whole district is going up by virtue of all this growth, and that improves increases the property taxes, which in turn then allow the city to finance the infrastructure with bonds that will be paid back by the equivalent of those property taxes. And so the private entities that are going down there will pay property taxes into that, and we will pay the equivalent of that over a 20-year period out of our parking program, out of the entire transportation program, which is operated like a business. It's operated as a self-sustaining entity. We all pay quite a bit, actually, each month to park, and that parking is then operated in a self-sustaining way. We don't put university budget. It's operated as an auxiliary in our parlance, but it means that we don't put general funds into it. Just the parking fees themselves go into funding it.
Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to leave in about 2 minutes for an appointment. Dr. Halleck, I understand what your investment, OHSU's investment is in this project. It's my understanding the project's costs have basically quadrupled since they were first assessed. Does that mean your cost has gone up significantly as a result of that?
They have gone up in part because of steel, and prices have increased, mm-hmm. and in part because of the dollar. The trams are actually manufactured in Switzerland, and there is an increase there as well. Our costs have increased. They haven't exactly tripled, but they have increased. Those are now built into this business plan, those increased costs, and again, not funded by the university operating budget, but by the transportation infrastructure budget, which is the separate entities, like a separate business, basically. And they're paid over a 20-year period. So by our cost, what I mean by that is that participants at OHSU who pay to park each month do help pay for them. The university budget does not.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Chair Devlin, Dr. Halleck, on this one spreadsheet I have here, your depreciation shows it's $61.5 million, something like that. And your net unrealized change in fair market value of investments is increases $3 million. I was wondering if how you came to that $3 million. It seems like a pretty low for your balance sheet. It seems like a pretty low increase given the location and the value of that land. I was wondering, is that taxable income or is that fair market assessment?
Hey. Do you want to answer that, Irene? Because I don't think that I think it's a different portion of the budget where that comes in.
Thank you. Good morning. The increase.
Your name?
Irene Barhide, Assistant Comptroller at OHSU. The change in fair market value of investments that you're looking at, mm-hmm. I believe, is actually the change in marketable investments, and it does not have anything to do with any of the land. We book the land when we receive it at the fair market value, and then it stays at that value through time.
Stock invested.
What's that?
It's stock.
Right. The line you're looking at is stock and bonds that has increased in value. So not fixed assets.
So what you're doing, then you ignore the appreciated value of the land in your balance sheet.
Correct. Which is the accounting, which follows the accounting guidance. Because in essence, we are not going to sell that land. It's not marketable right now. We are going to use it for future development. Yeah. Once it is on your balance sheet, you do not increase it.
That's a fascinating way of looking at it. Thank you.
We've all found GASB rules very fascinating. At this point, I would like to introduce Hilma Meneses, who is the director of the Affirmative Action Equal Opportunity Program at OHSU.
Thank you, Wendy.
And she's going to give you a brief summary of the material we mentioned to you last time is included in your blue notebooks under some of the tabs there. Hilma may be able to tell you exactly which tabs. Hilma?
Good morning, Mike.
Before we proceed, I did have one question. I was going back. I'm trying to actually put this all in place. You show a declining net revenue from the hospital in your fiscal year 2005 to your fiscal year 2006. Is that primarily based on the governor's budget and the lack of an $11 million subsidy for undercompensated care?
Thank you. Yes, that's a very large component of it. An additional aspect of the governor's budget was a reduction in the Medicaid reimbursement rate to OHSU. So in addition to the appropriation reduction, there's a Medicaid reduction as well.
Okay. So if we restore part of that Medicaid reduction, then that helps you also.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Good morning. My name is Hilma Meneses, and I'm the Director of Affirmative Action and Equal Opportunity at OHSU. I've been there approximately 3.5 years, going on 4. Before you, in your materials, tab 3 of your notebook, you have an Affirmative Action Plan narrative summary. If you wish, we would be happy to provide you with the entire plan. However, it is about 10 binders long, and each binder is about 3 to 4 inches. So, nonetheless, they are available for you. The first thing that I'd like to show you is the demographics of OHSU broken down by gender and race, so you have an idea of what we look like there. We have 64% female at OHSU and 36% male. That's an excellent ratio for a higher level institution. The workforce analysis, this is the workforce analysis taken from the affirmative action plan, and it's divided into job groups. The first job group, as you can see, are the executive and administrative positions at OHSU, and as you can see, we have a total of 677 in that job group, 411 of which are female, and we'll get to racial minority in just a tad. This is the total population of OHSU divided by race demographics. And as you can see, 84% are Caucasian, with about 16% being racial minority. This breaks down the racial minority workforce analysis by race and gender. And again, it's broken down into job groups with much more detail in the actual plan. This is an excellent summary of the total plan. The total population at OHSU being 11,686, minorities 1,888, which again comprises of about 16%. And black, Hispanic, Asian American, Indian are the categories that we totalize, calculate according to the Code of Federal Regulations. I'd like to quickly tell you a little bit about our achievements at OHSU. In our program, when I came to OHSU 4 years ago, the university did not have much of a civil rights program. In 4 years, we've been able to put an extremely strong program together, and I have to say that it's probably the strongest in the state of Oregon as far as a civil rights program is concerned. And if there is a better one out there, I'd like to know which one it is, because I would love to learn from them. Nonetheless, We actively work with departments in recruiting, hiring, and promotion processes. However, another goal is to prevent discrimination in the workplace, which encompasses conducting investigations of discrimination of racial minorities and women and peoples with disabilities. On a yearly basis, we conduct a comprehensive analysis of OHSU's workforce to determine the areas of underrepresentation in female and minority populations, which is a large part of the plan. We've developed diversity criteria for inclusion in all performance evaluations at OHSU. This is new. With the guidance and leadership of Dr. Kohler, we've been able to convince the executive team that in their performance evaluations, they will have to put in a diversity component as a criteria for evaluating their performance. This is an excellent step towards increasing diversity at any organization, because if it doesn't commence at the top, then it doesn't filter down. And if people are being accountable through their performance evaluations, which often is connected to compensation, then they'll be accountable to actually increasing the numbers of minorities and women, and to remedy underutilization of minorities and women.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, and good morning.
Good morning, Senator.
Commend you for your work over these past few years. Some outstanding things are taking place at OHSU. With regard to the performance evaluations, and I agree, that is an excellent step. Looking at the in tab 3 on page, starting on page 20, you identify some problem areas that you are targeting that will increase your efforts around diversity and remedying underrepresentation. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are around the development of a performance measure. If the co-chairs were to suggest a performance measure tied to the areas that you have identified as being problem areas, specifically a performance measure tied to results.
The performance measure will be tied to results. Although we have identified goals for each department and department head, they in turn will also have to develop and implement their own diversity goals. And what I mean by that is not only develop a goal of a certain percentage, but rather a goal to achieve those percentages.
Right.
So, to give you an example, if the goal for a particular department is to hire 10% more minorities, they can certainly say that, but they also have to show us what they are going to do to fulfill that goal. Are they going to provide mentorship programs for their current minorities in the institution? Are they going to go out of state and try to recruit minorities from a certain region that has a high percentage of minorities? Are they going to provide certain incentives to the high schools and colleges to increase the pipeline for minorities and women? So if they develop a plan that includes incentives like that, and they are successful in ultimately achieving their goal, then obviously they're going to be successful in their performance. Having said that, if they are not successful in achieving their goal of a certain percentage of minorities and women, but they are very instrumental in trying to get there, they're making good faith efforts to get there, then that's also recognized. Which, and the law suggests that we have to recognize their good faith efforts.
I appreciate those comments. And, Mr. Chair, my recommendation will be that as we're looking at the performance measures already developed for LHSU, that we ask them to work with Mr. Bender around language for a performance measure that's tied directly to their affirmative action plan, and those areas in the affirmative action plan that have been identified as problem areas. Does that make sense?
It does.
We're on track.
Okay.
Sure. Yes, Senator Whitson.
Chair Devlin, Spinesis, I was wondering, going back to page 29, you have almost 2-to-1 female over male ratio. In the nursing profession, you have 6.4% male and 93.6% female, which is like an eight times equity. And then moving forward a little bit in the science and engineering, the minority is almost 2x of equity. I wonder if you're actually looking at the other side of that coin, that when you've overrepresented the female representation, and sometimes you've overrepresented the minorities.
Absolutely. The School of Nursing, for example, has a high percentage of females, and one recommendation that I've made to them is to increase the numbers of males in their respective body. So although we don't establish specific goals for the increase of males in this particular plan, that is one component that they will be implementing in their specific diversity plans within their unit. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. And I guess the other thing, Mr. Chair, that just jumps off the page is almost a 2-to-1 ratio of females to males in the whole OHSU population.
That's partly due to the fact that we have a large population of nurses, which goes back to the School of Nursing. And the nurses at the whole university.
Approximately how many of the 11,000 employees are nurses?
About
1,500 members of ONA. That's
1,500 members of ONA plus the faculty at the School of Nursing and other researchers as well. So we have a large population of nurses. And now, whereas I would say several years ago, the population of doctors were... females were underrepresented in the School of Medicine many years ago. Now they're 52%. So the increase of females at the School of Medicine is also a fabulous thing. Mm-hmm. And my guess is that the increase of males in the nursing field is going to be seen as we progress as well.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. The ratio in veterinary medicine now is approximately 8-2 female to male in the across the United States.
Wow, that's amazing.
Okay. The other, only other one thing that I needed to say for under this page is that Dr. Hallock presented to you some information about South Waterfront earlier. Dr. Kohler asked me if a few months ago, or actually almost a year ago, are we going to be able to fulfill our 35% minority and women workforce in the trades? And I said to Dr. Kohler, and he's here to tell me if I said something differently, I said to Dr. Kohler, only if you attack it from a regional perspective. You presently do not have the availability that the project is demanding. However, if you attack it from a regional perspective and start developing minorities and women, giving them the tools to become apprentices and to go into the trades, then of course you will over a course of time. But the reality is that we have to attack it from a regional perspective, not just from an OHSU South Waterfront perspective. And as a result, Dr. Kohler and his executive team have successfully started with various partners in the region, private, public unions as well, and government bodies. They've started put together an organization called CAUSE. This organization will aim at working with the existing social service agencies that help minorities and women, including ETAP, the City of Portland, so that the minority and women population in the trades is increased, that they're giving the tools they need to work on this project. In addition, the CROIT has applied for a $3.5 million grant to train minorities and women in construction cleanup trades, which is another way to get them in there. If you have more, there are a lot of information. There's information in your packet about the mandatory online training as well. There's information on your packet about the specific demographics of the School of Dentistry, meaning 15% of the faculty are minority, 22% are female, and we actively recruit throughout the United States for those positions. Similarly, at the School of Medicine, the School of Medicine meets with search committees and with their search committee and our department to try to improve their goals and prepare their diversity implementation. This, in September 2004, School of Medicine was granted a Health Careers Opportunity Program grant from Health Resources and Services Administration, providing in-depth experiences through the educational pipeline to enable disadvantaged students to successfully progress into health careers. School of Nursing, 4% of the faculty are minority. This is a problem area, and we've identified that to Dean Potempa and her deans. 93%, as you know, are female because nursing is a traditionally female field, as we said earlier. They are actively trying to improve their programs and work with our office to improve their minority faculty population. Some of the school strategies and initiatives to increase diversity. OGI, School of Engineering, has an exceptional percentage of minorities and women. 17% of the faculty are minority, 20.5% are female. Many of the faculty at OGI come from other parts of the world and bring a breadth of cultural competence to the university. The school pipeline programs at OGI, the faculty serve as mentors to girls in grades 6 and up through the Advocate for Women in Science, Engineering, Mathematics program, something we're all very proud of. Program leaders to high school. There are program leaders to high school minority student scientists through the apprenticeship in science and engineering program. There are mentors to college undergraduate interns also. The Center for Diversity and Multicultural Affairs is an exceptional program that, again, addresses the pipeline so that in the future we can have an availability of minorities in the healthcare and sciences. Diversity, ethnic student enrollment, this is the makeup of the ethnic student enrollment. As you can see, 73% are Caucasian, but our minority population is increasing. And the data source is the OES Institutional Research Services.
Question here, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
This is the pool.
Yes. Would you talk to us about cultural competence, which you briefly referenced, and what does cultural competence mean for your institution?
I think it depends on who you ask at our institution, but certainly for some of us, it means being able to understand the different backgrounds and cultures
of people, and that includes not just racial minority or race as a whole, but it includes disabilities, it includes religion, it includes socioeconomic situations in our various lives. Cultural competence is being able to work with or care for a patient of a different culture, regardless of your differences. And I would hope that various people at OHSU would think in the same lines, and I know that some of them do. As an example, we have a group of psychiatrists right now who have been working with me on a grant to go to Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo so that they can increase their cultural competency and not only help AIDS orphans, but also come back to the United States and be able to help people here of in similar situations. They're going to hopefully achieve and be able to get this grant. If so, then they'll be eligible for a $4 million grant through NIH if they're successful. That's just an example of how of what my vision of or interpretation is of cultural competency.
Excellent example. Thank you.
We should probably
yep.
skip ahead.
Mm-hmm.
In the interest of time, we have a segment here on the Center for Diversity and Multicultural Affairs, which is really the student side of Hilma's office, and it is one we've presented before. I have material in here, and I'd be happy to discuss it, but I'm a little concerned about time, and if you're prepared, I'd like to skip ahead to the healthcare system and respond to Senator Gordley's request on kind of a care for the poor approach. Is that all right?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd have, if we can, one question before we go on, and this has to do with the discrimination against aging in the schools of medicine, specifically in the School of Dentistry, which is a case example that I have. And I would like to know what kinds of policies you have and if you take active steps to ensure there isn't discrimination against aging.
You want to answer?
Certainly, I'd like to answer that. Our civil rights program at OHSU does not only include race and gender. It includes age as well as religion and disabilities. And it's as equally important, in my opinion, and certainly in the opinion of our leadership at OHSU, there continues to be discrimination against the aging population. Luckily, our policies and our code of conduct prohibit discrimination against the aging population, as we do with other protected classes. We have. In the event we have a reduction in force at times, we do an EEO analysis, and the EEO analysis includes a review of whether the aging population is being affected, because usually in a reduction in force, that's the group that is affected or could be affected most.
There's a claim of discrimination.
Could I follow with a question? I mean, clearly at some point, it is non-productive as far as society is concerned to admit someone to medical school.
Right.
I mean, while I might be able to pass all of the necessary exams and provide all of the other credentials, that it would seem counterproductive for someone of my age to be admitted to medical school. Best case scenario, I might be able to look forward to finishing medical school, but never have the opportunity to or the privilege of practicing. Is there any sort of formula in relationship to the School of Medicine or the School of Dentistry where there are cutoff ages that applicants can just as well apply out of state if they get beyond that?
My understanding is that there are no cutoff ages. It depends on the ability of that person. And the boards, of course, of medicine will also have an impact as to whether or not that person is capable of practicing medicine. No, but there is no age limit. If you could be 95 years old and have perfect hands of a surgeon and certainly perform surgery, on the other hand, if you're not competent and you're 25-year-old. I think it depends on the individual, sir.
You probably probably would be unhappy to hear that I have a real-life case out there of a lady who was who has been unsuccessful in her seeking admission to the School of Dentistry, in spite of having all of the credentials, and in spite of the fact having been admitted to several dental schools across the United States that would indicate some qualification. And I,
if I may, I think I know the case, and I won't say the name at this hearing, but I do. I think I know the case that you're referring to, and I can assure you that my office has reviewed her matter, and there are two sides of the story, and I would be happy to discuss with you after the hearing if you'd like. But her matter has been reviewed by our office.
That's what I'm interested in. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, before before we go on, I do want to say on the record a couple of other things about the challenges and opportunities, and I want to put the emphasis on opportunities, the word opportunities, for OHSU. Looking at the institution's analysis of problem areas and looking specifically at page 24 under tab 3, and the section titled Faculty, we see that OHSU currently underutilizes women and minorities in the professor job category. Minorities are underutilized in the associate professor job category. Minorities are underrepresented in the assistant professor category. Minorities are underrepresented in the instructor category. Minorities are underrepresented in the lecturer category. In the staff scientist category, minorities are well represented. In the adjunct faculty category, again, minorities are underrepresented. And again, I'm just saying this out loud, just as an example of what are the challenges and opportunities at OHSU. They clearly have a plan, strategic plan, for meeting the challenges, but I think that a performance measure, as I stated earlier, will help us track progress and performance. And again, I would just like to commend the institution for work that has been accomplished over a short period of time. 3.5 years.
Dr. Kallick, how much time do you need to complete your...
We'll take what time you tell us we have.
Okay. How much time did you plan for your remaining areas?
About 20 minutes.
20 minutes. I think we can do that.
Okay.
Please.
We can be briefer, as you wish. The next segment is really President Kohler's, and we wanted to talk a little bit about a vision for healthcare for all urban.
Dr. Hallock and I each have 20 minutes on this list to present in 20 minutes, so I will shorten mine up. But a couple of things I do want to point out again to you. I think Dr. Hallock has already referenced this report, which is toward the back of your material. It will probably be turned into a white paper from this institution, but it was initiated at the request of Senator Gordley, and it is, I think, something about my presentation will track this. It's something about the future and about what we're doing currently. I also have a letter from one of our long-term supporters, Senator Hatfield, for distribution. Thank you. I will shorten my presentation up. If I press the right thing here. This is just a little bit about who comes to OHSU. I think you can see there that 40% come from outside the Tri-County area, and 40% of our hospital patients are low income, either Medicaid or uninsured, which is twice the state average. I should point out that the satisfaction independently gathered, not from OHSU, about the experience people have at our hospital is quite good, and we are winning the Consumer's Choice Award consistently for the top many things, hospitals, doctors, nurses, and so forth. As you know, we're the only academic health center in Oregon. Our patients are sicker than they are in other hospitals, and I think that's an important thing to recognize. However, on a case-adjusted basis, we have the lowest mortality. That's a marker for quality. And again, you can see we have the largest number of medically underserved patients in the state. A little bit about our system. This is just a very partial list. University Hospital, OHSU Hospital now called, Dornbecker Children's Hospital, the outpatient clinics, I'll go into these a little bit more later, several specialty institutes, including the KCI Institute and others. You've heard about our schools, and between our medical school and our nursing school, the faculty of our schools generally are appointed to the staff at the hospital as well, so there's a good blend there. In fact, that's why these schools work so much in harness with the hospital. The third component is the medical group, which has been consolidated from 40 practices into one major practice, which has allowed us to really operate with them in a more traditional way with an academic health center faculty. And in fact, they've been willing to take risk. They're the ones that took out most of the bond money necessary to build the clinic that's going up on the river. So these three partners are key. The UMG has 700 clinicians. I mentioned, it is a 501c3. It provides the dean's tax, and also it provides base salary support for the departments, which in many ways go back to help subsidize the various programs, research, clinical, and education. The contributions, for example, in this fiscal year, probably 30% of the gross private income from the faculty members goes into some form of support. And I think that's a key feature. It's sort of an unrecognized or perhaps invisible subsidy to the programs that we have. In addition, the University Hospital, together with UMG, transferred about $63 million in support to the schools of medicine and nursing in the fiscal year 04. As Dr. Halleck has indicated already, we heavily subsidize our educational mission with the clinical revenue. Our population, we are a very large provider of care for the vulnerable. 30% of our incomes have, 30% of Oregonians have incomes below 200% of the federal poverty level. 20% of all adults in Oregon are uninsured. That number may be going up. And in the Tri-County area, over 200,000 people are uninsured. They often find their way to our door. We continue to feel that this is an important part of our mission, and the next slide shows a little bit about who we care for specifically. The Dornbecker Children's Hospital, very high number of poor children. Dental care, here are a number of venues in which dental care is provided around the state and the Portland metropolitan area for children who need dental work. This is a very serious problem in children, as you may know. And so we think the school there is serving a particularly important need. The next slide shows a number of our activities that I think are important. The Nursing School Network for Rural Schools, particularly in Eastern Oregon, this has turned out to be a good solution, I think, to care for the Medicaid and uninsured population. But we also have school clinics in the Washington County area. They counsel unwed mothers and teens with substance abuse and so forth. We have a midwifery service that does a large number of deliveries, mostly on Medicaid patients. Oregon Health Plan, the Elgin Union Clinics I referenced. We also have a good relationship with the Salvation Army and their White Shield program there that is for unwed mothers, often with other problems, who have children. and need to be cared for. CDRC, you've heard about a great deal. In spite of what you heard in terms of the testimony the other day, a lot of the programs were protected. We do a lot of things that people would also be in here to complain about if they were cut. And so I think trying to figure out how you heard the principles we use to try to guide us. But, for example, we have programs through the CDRC throughout the entire state. This is the Cocoon program. It takes care of 10,000 children annually. And that is that was protected during the budget reduction because of the statewide impact and because it is the Title V match. But we have the community network statewide that I think serve a very important role. We have community clinics, and we believe this is a greater solution in the future, particularly as we can get these certified as federal programs that are either federally qualified health centers or the look-alike programs such as we have at Richmond right now. That's doing an excellent job because it gets cost reimbursement for Medicaid patients in breaking even. It's not quite breaking even yet, but it almost breaks even. And that's what we think is a model for us for the future as we can get these certified. The Scappoose Family Medicine Center is also a rural health clinic. And we have other clinics such as Gabriel Park that do a very large amount of care for the poor, those who cannot get care where they need it. The Paramix slide is from the Goldberg Report. And we've talked a little bit about definitions. I think it's going to be very important in the future that we come to a common way of reporting care for the poor. There are a lot of terms that float around there: bad debt, charity care, uncompensated care. I think they need to be all made the same for all the reporting agencies. Our problem in terms of compensation, you can see, by the way, the next slide shows the amount of care provided to the underserved. This is based on discharges. You can see there that we are roughly twice the other systems. Kaiser would not be on this chart because they don't take people unless they're members there. You can see that the legacy health system is increasing somewhat, but we still do a very large part. The next slide shows the Tri-County area. Notice that our market share for total patients is about 11% of the total. Our Medicaid market share is about 21%, and our non-sponsored market share is about 44%. Now, the next slide is a very important one. I think this is one that may be a little hard to read, but hopefully you have a copy of it. As you know, we have a large number of Medicaid patients. And we also get, we are a publicly qualified hospital, so we get pass-throughs. Now, this slide shows you how Medicaid, non-sponsored, and Medicare are reflected on our bottom line. And all that red is just what it shows. These are losses. And you can see that we lose on Medicaid. We now lose on Medicare. During the years when the federal government had a special pass-through, we actually came out slightly ahead on Medicaid. We were part of the provider tax that was instituted in the last session, and that decreases the losses somewhat. But you can see here that the loss of state appropriation will further make this a problem to us, as will the reduction in Medicaid payments overall. So this is after all the pass-throughs and after all the other money is counted in that we get from anybody to take care of poor people. I think I probably should skip through these other slides. This shows we serve the entire state. We actually do more care for the we act like the county hospital for many states, or for many areas of the state. The red shows places where we do above 200% of the county rate. The yellow is 100 to 200% of the county rate, and only in those shown in white are we actually below the county rate in terms of taking care of the poor. Now, I want to wrap up with two slides that I think are important. One is that with the looming problem, although it may get better in the future, of the uninsured, no single provider, particularly one that's losing revenue in the way we are, can take care of everybody. We need to build a safety net that works. Vulnerable populations need to be served. We're certainly going to be a major part of that. But I think there's a need to look at the Medicaid reimbursement rates for the state and how they're affecting everybody, not just OHSU, but rural hospitals that are not able to get cost reimbursement are also pretty drastically affected by the cutbacks in Medicaid, the population being so large there. I think we need to work together for a comprehensive solution, and that means shared responsibility and the consistent reporting of data. I think we need to be innovative. There are a lot of opportunities in the future to deliver health care in a more efficient way than we're doing it right now, utilizing IT, and I belong to one IT health group that's trying to look at this problem. I think there are other innovations. You may have seen recently some information about our starting an infirmary with the Salvation Army. We think this will serve that intermediate role, like subacute care, that sometimes can be provided in nursing homes, but is often not available to the homeless. This will particularly affect the homeless in the Portland metropolitan area, and I think it will be something based on volunteer activity from our faculty and staff, and the ability of the Salvation Army to provide the infrastructure, a much less expensive form of care for people who badly need it, and those who do need to be in the hospital will, of course, be admitted. But I'd like to end up with a request that a broad-based task force be charged to bring back a solution or proposed solution to the legislature or the emergency board so that we can work in a coordinated way on this particular problem. I think when you say things have to get worse before they can get better, we are there, and I think there's a willingness now of the other health systems as well to work with us in getting toward this kind of solution.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Cole, for that last statement. Last Thursday, I had a meeting with Senators Whitsitt and Representative Wisnant and Steve Bender to discuss this whole funding surrounding OHSU, because I find it completely fascinating and interesting, and wondering how we got to this point. And what is interesting is that Mr. Bender doesn't even know what all the agreements have been made orally with OHSU and the legislature since you were cut loose in 95. I've talked with Senator Schrader and Senator Devlin, and it's my desire to put a budget note in your funding bill that indicates that we will get together in the interim and figure out what the heck is going on, and have the legislature participate in that, because this is ridiculous. This whole show that we have to go through for your funding, when there was an understanding that we didn't need to fund you anymore, and there's an understanding that, yes, we did need to fund you anymore. So I think we need to get to the bottom of it, and I'm hopeful that we can do that through a budget note, and I appreciate that you're on board with that.
Senator Walker, we will be in the process of putting together such a budget note, and I will ensure that the entire committee has an opportunity to participate in that, along with representatives of OHSU. Dr. Kohler, in addition to that, though, is speaking about the long-term issues of undercompensated care, which is a much broader issue than OHSU's situation. OHSU is part of the situation, and I think that's what his request was for a task force, was to look at the issue of undercompensated care. But I understand the committee's interest in a budget note reflecting both the co-chair's concerns that's expressed in his letter, and we now have a response from OHSU in that regard. And before we get to phase three, we will actually develop a budget note on that particular issue. The issue of a task force on undercompensated care probably is far more the purview of the Human Services Subcommittee than it is the purview of this committee. So.
Then, Mr. Chair, yes. We need to just make a note at this point that we need to make some form of recommendation to the Human Services Committee that we are looking at the need for such a task force, and at the point where it is appropriate, we would like to have their weigh-in
on this. I just see that whole subject area as being very, very critical and needing our attention, and just grateful for the leadership of OHSU, or for the leadership that they're willing to provide to such a task force.
Understood, Senator Gordley. Dr. Halleck, I'll give you your preference to be able to do your 20 minutes in 2 minutes, or come back tomorrow and use no more than 15 minutes.
You know, we're happy to do either one, whichever you prefer.
I think it might be better for you to come back tomorrow morning, to be honest. We are so close to 10:30, and I've got members that are going to start running out. So why don't we do that? You come back tomorrow morning. Committee tomorrow, in addition to OHSU finishing up, we will have the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. And then on Wednesday, we will have the work sessions on the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission and on the State Library. And on Thursday, we will have the large public hearing on the Oregon University System.
Will we have a meet on Friday, by chance?
My expectation, which may be all wrong, to be honest, we have not had a full committee meeting in a long time. My expectation would be that there'd be a high prospect that we might be meeting on Friday. However, I do know that there is some discussions going on in the building, and if those discussions are fruitful, then I think we will have a meeting on Friday. If they are not fruitful, I don't know what we are doing on Friday.
So, in other words, I can't make my plans for Friday yet.
Yeah.
But if we had a meeting, it would be in the morning.
Friday is.
Yes, the 4 would be in the morning. We actually have a great deal of material actually pending for the fall, because I think a lot of the subcommittees have been kicking out small budgets and also a number of different grant applications that have to be acted on by the fall. So, but that's the co-chair's decision, not mine.
Just trying to plan my day, Mr. Chair, since I'm in committee 6 hours a day. It's hard to squeeze the time.
I understand that, Senator Walker. I very much understand that. Well, with that, I will close this hearing, close this committee, and see Dr. Halleck back tomorrow morning. You do not have to bring a full contingent tomorrow unless you want to.
I think I'm right.